10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut. Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 24th of June in the glorious future year of 2023, and I am coming to you by pre-recording. Yesterday, I had intended to go out to the Texas Stamp Dealers Association show in Richardson, Texas, and get me some more space and atomic energy-themed postage stamps. And, you know, if I had left the house about an hour earlier than I did, it probably would have worked out that way, too, which is a constant refrain from me. As it was, however, I had a couple of other errands to run before I headed over to the other side of the metro mess, 100 kilometers away or so, and, as I was doing so, a violent thunderstorm blew up, which persisted for rather longer than the brief summer thundershowers we sometimes get. And I have a certain reluctance to risk my life unnecessarily, so I decided that I would go today. So there's been quite a deal of coverage in the newspapers this week of the loss of a submersible called Titan, which was constructed for the ghoulish purpose of taking the well-heeled down to gawk at the mass grave site known as the wreck of the RMS Titanic. And some people have said, with all this effort being directed towards this billionaire's plaything, what about boats with hundreds of migrants on them reported potentially lost in the Mediterranean? And I think there are some instructive lessons here regarding how we think about things, and in particular how the gentlemen of the press think about things. From one side, we can observe that this maritime tragedy in the Mediterranean is the result of a deliberate government policy on the part of the governments of Italy and Greece, which, along with some other European states, have been pursuing the politics of purity. Migrants, they're outsiders, they're foreigners, they are unclean, and therefore, by definition, they're dangerous, and therefore they must be stopped from coming, if at all possible, even if stopping them from coming means that they die. And those who do arrive, who cannot be stopped from coming, well, they must be carefully isolated from the good, pure, clean people. They have to be kept in camps, or else who knows what disorders might arise. And so, because many people in Italy and Greece particularly, but other European states, including Hungary, have been propagandized into believing that their economic distress and various social phenomena they're having difficulty with are the result of the unclean, the foreigners, the queers, you name it, these kinds of policies, though unspeakably cruel, are accepted, and there's no appeal to your journalists in reporting about them. A second aspect, of course, is that the loss of the submersible enables the journalists to trot out a favorite theme which always plays well with the public along the lines of, "Has man gone too far?" The overweening scientists and technicians, etc., 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 which is, honestly, a very stupid spin to put on most stories that are spun that way, but particularly this one, simply because the much better take on it is that billionaires don't like being told no. Billionaires don't like being told that what they're doing is unwise and will fail. They are people who are accustomed to being told that every word which drops from their mouth is golden. They are people who are accustomed to being told yes. And this is probably a case of survivorship bias. Because, of course, for every person who becomes a billionaire, there are tens of millions who don't. And some reasonable number, perhaps 1,000, perhaps 1,000,000 of those, set out to become billionaires and failed along the way. Every billionaire, undoubtedly, has been told at some point that what he was doing was unwise, but it worked out for him, and so he's learned to disregard advice that says he shouldn't do what he has an intention of doing. Even though it's very likely that whatever it was worked out for him, not because he's smarter or more foresighted than the people who were telling him it was unwise, but simply by way of random chance. Billionaires don't believe in random chance. Billionaires certainly don't believe that the deck is stacked in their favor. Billionaires believe that they've become billionaires by being wiser and overall better than everyone else. And so, if someone says, this is a really unwise thing to do, a billionaire will say, ha ha, shows what you know, we're going to do it anyway. Successful politicians are often much the same, which is one reason, certainly not the only reason, but one reason, why both species are a plague upon mankind. From a legalistic perspective, I do wonder why the Canadian Coast Guard allowed the vessel carrying the submersible to leave port if the Canadian Coast Guard was not perfectly satisfied of the soundness of the submersible. It seems to me that under the Saving of Life at Sea regulations, they had every basis for impounding it, for stopping it from leaving port. You know, this is an important difference between a wreck diving submersible and private space travel. People who are described as personal spaceflight participants, because they're not in the legal position of passengers, are required to sign all kinds of waivers and forms saying that they understand the activity is dangerous and they have no legal recourse if they're harmed or killed, etc., etc., etc. Same for people who go down in wreck diving submersibles, and so on. But in the case of the personal spaceflight participant, you can't just launch, you can't just fly any old thing. The civil aviation authorities take an enormous amount of interest in these spacecraft because they know that if the launch goes bad, or the landing goes bad, or various other things go bad, a very large amount of kinetic energy may be delivered to unsuspecting members of the general public in the form of things falling on them, or in the form of explosion blast waves, for example. So the civil aviation authorities are not going to allow something to pass which has any particular likelihood of proving a danger to the general public. If you're the constructor or owner or operator of the vehicle, you have to prove a high level of safety to be allowed to fly it. Apparently, this doesn't quite apply in the case of these hobbyist submersibles. There is, of course, also a technical aspect to all of this. Because pressure vessel design is a pretty well-known art. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers Boiler Code, which is based on generations and generations of experience of avoiding deadly steam boiler explosion accidents, mostly, and a variety of other kinds of accidents, as well as the experience of accidents that weren't adequately avoided, that did occur, that killed people, that damaged equipment and facilities, is followed by practically everybody in the world. And so when you design a pressure vessel, you typically design it to stand up to 2 or 4 times the maximum pressure that you expect it to encounter in service. And then, before putting it into service, you proof test it to 120 or 150% of the expected maximum pressure in service. It's not clear that that was done in the case of this submersible. Furthermore, there's the question of materials. You see, the submersible was made largely of carbon fiber composites, which are wonderful materials. I have nothing against them, but using them for pressure vessels is tricky. It's tricky because they don't have the same kinds of material properties that conventional metals have. The ASME boiler code and every other pressure vessel code are designed primarily with steel in mind. And steel has what's known as a linear stress strain curve. Basically, you apply a force to steel, and it changes shape slightly. You take that force away, and it returns to its original shape. The kind of force you have to apply to distort it permanently is way out beyond that margin of safety level, 2 times or 4 times, for example, that I spoke of earlier. Carbon fiber and other composites behave in fundamentally different ways. when you load them and then unload them, the fibers may creep past one another. There can be other kinds of behavior that result in a non-linear stress-strain curve, with the decidedly nasty result that you could build a submersible, which went down to 4,500 meters perfectly safely the first time, and the second time, and the third time, and then on the fourth or fifth time, crunch! There has been a great deal of work done on, for example, filament-wound carbon fiber pressure vessels as breathing gas tanks for divers, because a lighter weight tank, which allows higher internal pressures, is something that divers obviously really want, and will also be good in space. But the construction of those tanks, as it's been found, has to be very specialized and very careful, and those tanks have a lifetime limit. Yes? You can't just use them over and over and over. You have to discard them after a number of fills and empties, which is considerably smaller than the number of fills and empties of a conventional metal tank. Carbon fiber composites simply have a basically different mechanical behavior. And so we need a new set of design codes for composite pressure vessels that's not going to closely resemble the ones for metal pressure vessels. And not just because composite pressure vessels are usually used at much lower temperatures than a boiler. Now, a thing I saw in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks back was a headline trumpeting, "For the first time ever this year, investments in solar are bigger than investments in oil." And I find this quite an interesting headline. Because the question really is not how much money is invested in solar versus how much money is invested in oil projects, but how much energy those investments return. And I have strong suspicions that the solar investments will return much less energy than the oil investments. Although, the energy return on investment of conventional fossil fuels projects is falling all the time. We've burned up the easy oil, the easy gas, the easy coal, and so we have to go farther afield for it. We have to do undersea drilling, which is more expensive than land drilling. We have to do undersea drilling in the Arctic, or even land drilling in the Arctic. That ain't cheap either. We have to go after oil shales and tar sands and gas in tight formations. So the energy return from investments in fossil fuels keeps creeping downward. And to some extent, energy returned from renewable energy investments has been creeping upward, but not enthusiastically. And in some cases, it's been creeping upward because of, let's say, silicon wafers produced in China using large amounts of fossil fuel with next to no emission controls and possibly quartzite mined by forced labor. I think those aspects would have to be counted in any realistic evaluation. But more broadly, the United States today, as a very round estimate, has about a terawatt of equivalence to reliable electric generating capacity, of which about 100 gigawatts is nuclear. Now, everybody who's studied the subject at all realistically concludes that electrifying cars, electrifying home heating and cooling, electrifying cooking, that kind of thing, is going to require a substantial increase in electricity output, a doubling or tripling of generation. So say, at a minimum, something like 2 terawatts of firm generating capacity, or its equivalent. That would be 20 times today's installed base of nuclear power if we wanted to do it all with nuclear, which is firm and emissions-free. To build 2 terawatts of nuclear power, let's say 1 gigawatt reactors, that's 2,000 of them. Over 20 years, that would be 100 a year, right, as many as we have now every single year, which would mean starting construction, or more importantly, completing construction, of 2 units every week. Now that is an enormous burden on industry. And if we look at the world as a whole, to shift over from fossil fuels to electricity and nuclear energy, we could probably say, you know, the United States has about 5% or 1/20th of the world's population, consumes a considerably larger fraction than that of the world's energy production. So it might be reasonable to say that overall, the world would need to build 10 times as many power units as the United States. So that would be, in terms of 1 gigawatt nuclear plants, 20 every week, 4 every workday. That's a lot. That's got to be a huge strain on the world's industrial resources to build all those things. Well, here's the real kick in the teeth. If we're talking firm generating capacity, every 1 gigawatt nuclear plant is equivalent to between 5 and 10 gigawatts of wind and solar, plus a god-awful big battery pack. If 20 1 gigawatt nuclear power plants a week around the world is going to severely strain the world's industrial capacity, I can't see any way that trying to do that with wind and solar and batteries wouldn't utterly overburden the world's industrial capacity. Which leads me once again to the conclusion that the whole so-called energy transition from fossil fuels to electricity supplied by wind and solar is simply a false front, that there's no engineering reality behind it at all. Suppose we talk about 10 megawatt wind turbines, which are more or less the largest practicable size. And we say, well, the equivalent to a 1,000 megawatt nuclear plant is not 100, but more like 500 of these 10 megawatt wind machines. Plus a big battery bank. Don't forget that big battery bank. So in the United States alone, you're going to have 1,000 of these big wind machines put in every week? That really does seem like straining not only industrial capacity, but credulity itself. Particularly since it appears that the lifetime of these wind machines may be 12 to 15 years, in which case you wouldn't even get to the 20-year mark, right? Because you'd get to a certain point, 12 to 15 years out, all your new installations would be doing is replacing ones you'd already installed that were failing. And you're back in the Red Queen's race, where you have to run as fast as you possibly can just to stay where you are, and faster even than that to get ahead. Pardon me if this does not sound like a responsible energy, industrial, or economic policy, nor a responsible environmental policy. 1,000 giant wind machines a week in the US alone, 10,000 around the world every single week indefinitely. I'm not saying it absolutely couldn't be done, but the contemplation of it leads one to believe that any reasonable alternative deserves consideration. And I would say that I have given more than adequate grounds for supposing the nuclear alternative to be a reasonable one. Now, there is a very important objection that may be raised, which is that if you're building 100 gigawatts of new nuclear power capacity a year, much less, globally speaking, 1,000 gigawatts, you are rapidly going to make severe inroads on the world's available supplies of uranium. And of course, as I have suggested before, the answer to this is twofold. The first is that the reactors we build need to be more efficient of uranium, and will have to be, simply because, again, from a viewpoint of industrial capacity, building 100 gigawatt light water reactors a year is going to be a severe strain. A much less severe strain would be presented by 100 gigawatt CANDU type reactors. And it so happens that CANDU type reactors use considerably less uranium. They also don't require enrichment facilities, and they can make much more efficient use of recycled uranium from reprocessing the existing spent fuel from light water reactors. But it is also true that a substantial fraction of the reactors getting built will have to be breeder-type reactors. Reactors which take plutonium and depleted uranium and produce more plutonium out than they take in. Possibly also thorium in, uranium-233 out. Either way, as I've said before, it's a matter of the support ratio. There's good reason to believe that we can support 2 to 3 gigawatts of CANDU plant from 1 gigawatt of breeder plant, assuming we choose correctly the breeder technology and various other details of the system. So, for example, the Hanford site on the Columbia River in Washington State was examined in the 1970s, and the conclusion was reached that it could support 30 to 40 gigawatts of nuclear generating capacity just on that one site. 30 to 40 gigawatts is a decent chunk of the nation's 2 terawatt requirements. Now, if we have 30 to 40 gigawatts on the Hanford site, and that's all high-gain breeder reactors, which can support 2 to 3 times as much CANDU type capacity, then that means we can also put between 60 and 120 gigawatts elsewhere in the Mountain West and Pacific Northwest, all with their fuel cycle services handled from a reprocessing plant and breeder reactors on the Hanford site. The transportation challenges for doing this are modest, not in any way to be compared with coal trains or even with moving the blades and nacelles and towers of 1,000 10-megawatt wind machines a week. No radical breakthroughs in technology are required, only the implementation of technologies which have been around since the days of Douglas Point and EBR-II in the 1960s. But we have to start. Politicians, the press, every kind of business interest will have to align to make such a program possible. And I see few signs of that happening. People talk a lot about decarbonization. People talk a lot about so-called clean energy, but they're not prepared to take the necessary steps to make what they talk about mean anything. It's a sad fact that in our culture, the anti-nuclear attitudes are so firmly ingrained. Because, as I've said before, atomic energy is not merely the key to the survival of our civilization, which is an imperative which should weigh heavily upon us all. It's also one of the most magnificent achievements of the human intellect, which we ought to honor and value. The fact that it's not so honored and valued could reasonably be described as yet another poisonous fruit of anti-intellectualism. And anti-intellectualism has title to be regarded as one of the most destructive forces in our world today. Forget about climate change. The refusal to use, to accept, to praise the higher faculties of the human mind. All throughout human history, we have used those higher faculties to get ourselves out of difficulty, to assure our survival. We cannot turn our back on that now. We must, from whatever quarter of the political compass it emanates, reject the notion that my ignorance is as good as your knowledge. Do experts always lead us right? Well, no. But you're far more likely to go wrong by rejecting expert advice because it's unfamiliar, because you're sure you know better, than you are by taking it even though it makes you uncomfortable. It seems, then, that we need apostles and evangelists for atomic energy. People who are willing to say, this is a good thing, and I want it, and you should want it too. And I'm out here trying to be one of them. Remember that you have been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. I look forward to receiving your cards and letters. Write to Man and Atom, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I look forward to reading them over the air. I may send you something in return as well. If you find these broadcasts valuable and would like to support them, paypal.me/PrometheusLives for a one-time contribution, patreon.com/man_and_atom for a recurring one. And up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
Science Report presents Piano Tuning and Micro Worlds. Sound as though that piano is in tune? Well, it probably is, according to 20th century standards. The tuning of each key is equidistant in terms of tone from the key before and after. But during the 18th century, pianos were tuned differently. Dr. Owen Jorgensen of Michigan State University's School of Music tells how past pianists would feel about today's tuning methods.
It's very possible that the musicians would have considered a piano to be out of tune. Or at least crudely tuned. Maybe not totally or entirely out of tune or anything to that extent, but certainly not refined to the degree that they were used to.
Today's tuning is called equal temperament. 2 centuries ago, not all keys on a piano were the same tone from octave to octave. This gave chords from harpsichords and pianos a different tone. Some of the world's great composers, in fact, wrote with that kind of tone in view. Today, most musicians hardly realize that these instruments can have a different form of tuning.
In today's music world, there are very few musicians who are aware that the tuning of the 18th century was different. And mostly the people that are beginning to become aware of this are harpsichordists and some early 40 pianists.
Old world tuning is termed well-tempered. Today's tuning style, called equal temperament, evolved to fit the tone and color of more modern 19th and 20th century music. But if more contemporary music sounds harsh in old-style tuning, how does early music sound on today's pianos? Answers Dr. Jorgensen.
Music that was written for the old tuning and played in the modern temperament called equal temperament just simply lacks color. And the reason is that all of the tones are spaced exactly equally apart from each other. That would be very similar to looking at a painting reproduced in black and white.
Peering into minuscule worlds has always been an ambition of scientists. The first optical microscopes enabled researchers to see microorganisms. Today, technology has developed so that we are able to get a glimpse of molecules, and possibly in time to come, the very atoms of which molecules are made. The instrument that accomplishes this feat is called the transmission electron microscope. And physicist Murray Gibson of AT&T Bell Labs explains the basis for its capabilities.
A transmission electron microscope relies on very high energy electrons, which have sufficient energy to penetrate through a very thin sample of material and form an image which is very much like the image formed by an ordinary optical microscope.
Resolution is the key factor in viewing smaller worlds. Basically, no energy can delineate something smaller than its own wavelength. The smaller the wavelength, the higher the ability to distinguish smaller features. The illumination behind the transmission electron microscope comes from electrons. Dr. Gibson sums up the relation of resolution and wavelength.
Well, the advantage to electron microscopes as far as resolution is concerned is the wavelength. The ultimate resolution of any optical instrument, be it electron optics or X-rays or light, the familiar light microscope, is given by the wavelength of the radiation that is used to form the image.
A transmission electron microscope is able to magnify objects millions of times. On this scale, a baseball would appear as large as the Earth. Yet improvements for this hardware, which can already see large molecules, are in the offing. Brighter electron sources will help. So will better optical systems that take over where the electron beam leaves off. Yet one more benefit will come from a vibration-free environment, explains Dr. Gibson.
When you take a picture of a material, if there's any vibration, that vibration will blur the image and make it useless. And at the moment, we're at the level that motions that correspond to speeds of only 1 foot per century are sufficient to blur the pictures that we're taking.
This has been Science Report, presented by the American Institute of Physics. Scientists exploring the universe we live in, researching today for the world of tomorrow. This is Science Report. Today, vibroacoustics. Vibration. It can annoy or calm. Sound. It can foster serenity or destroy concentration. Put them together and you get the science of vibroacoustics. Just how the mixture of sound and vibration affects human beings is of critical importance, among other things, to our space program. Generally speaking, lower frequencies produce vibration, which is felt. Higher frequencies are more often transmitted as sound, which is heard. The combined effects of vibration and sound aren't simply added together. Often the two interact, producing an enhanced effect. Just how this enhanced effect influences human beings is the study of vibroacoustics. Dr. Kelly Wilshire, who works at NASA's Langley Research Center, elaborates.
Each particular person has their own limits or tolerance to noise and sound. Some people are very much annoyed or bothered by particular types of sounds, characteristics of sounds that wouldn't bother other people. So it's a very individualistic phenomenon.
Uncovering what parameters govern human response to a given condition of noise and vibration is the goal of vibroacousticians. Human psychology is a critical aspect of vibroacoustic research. It's also highly variable. Unbearable noise to an adult might be soothing music to a teenager.